I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, it's almost intuitive that eating and mood are linked. Advertising knows this all too well, advertising ice cream and chocolates as stress relievers. Well, now there's new research about the powerful relationship between depression and obesity. Today, we'll also talk about night eating syndrome, an eating disorder that is more prevalent worldwide than anorexia and bulimia combined, and yet it's only just been recognized by the new DSM-5. Now, for example, I've got a patient who watched her mother consume great volumes of food when the mother was distressed. When my patient had children of her own and became sleep deprived, she found herself consuming most of her calories between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. Is this genetics? Is it learned behaviors? Is it a byproduct of a sleep disorder? Well, helping us sort all of this out are doctors Kelly Allison and Lucy Falconbridge. They're both with the Penn Center for Eating Disorders. Falconbridge is one of the main pioneers in the field of obesity and depression. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Kelly Allison is one of the top experts on night eating syndrome. Specifically, she's the author of Overcoming Night Eating Syndrome, a step-by-step guide to breaking the cycle. Kelly, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Later in the show, we're going to be hearing from a bioengineer, Dr. Amit Geffen, who has some disturbing news for us about fat cells. And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Please call early in the show. The show's about mood and eating. Again, 888-477-9499. Lucy, when you began looking at the relationship between mood and obesity, you found there was almost nothing out there. That's really shocking.
Yeah, I was really surprised. One of the things that was the most shocking to me is that there just wasn't any treatments available for individuals who were obese and also suffered from major depressive disorder. And I asked why. I began to ask why that was so. And what I found was that most depressed individuals tend to be screened out of weight loss trials. And there's a couple reasons for that. But the result is that we just don't know that much about what happens to individuals with major depression when they attempt weight loss.
So now we know there's a strong relationship between mood and weight, but does weight loss improve mood in the obese, and or does diminished depression help them lose weight? Is there any way to separate those two out?
That's exactly the kinds of questions that we're interested in. So one of the reasons that depressed people have typically been screened out of these trials is that researchers were concerned that if they lost weight, that this would actually exacerbate their depression, or in individuals who weren't depressed to begin with, that weight loss would somehow cause depression in those people. And so we've begun to look at that question. And what we knew for some time was that in most trials, individuals actually show improvements in their mood as they lose weight. But those trials were mostly done with people who didn't have depression in the first place. Now we're recruiting people who are obese, they have clinical depression, and we are administering behavioral weight management, that's diet and exercise, for weight loss, and combining that with cognitive therapy for depression. And what we're observing is that actually depressed individuals can lose as much weight as non-depressed individuals, for the most part. So most depressed individuals actually can undertake weight loss safely, and they can achieve good results.
Lots of questions around that. We're going to have to ferret that out and see what the psychology and physiology is of that. That was Lucy Falconbridge, who studied extensively depression, mood disorders, and obesity. Give us a call at 888-477-9499. Kelly, I want to talk with you about night eating syndrome. I've got to tell you, I said to a lot of people I know that we're going to be talking about night eating syndrome. None of them heard the label before, and all of them kind of nodded to me this kind of guilty, shame-based acknowledgement that, yeah, I have some of that myself. So what is it?
Sure. So night eating syndrome is a delay in the circadian pattern of eating, such that folks are eating at least a quarter of their intake after their evening meal, and or they're waking up at night at least twice per week to eat. Those are the core characteristics. And usually people don't have much of an appetite for breakfast, as you can imagine, if you've been up eating during the night. And oftentimes their mood gets lower as the evening comes on. But one of the main thoughts or fears that folks with night eating have is that they might not be able to get to sleep initially or get back to sleep when they wake up in the middle of the night if they don't have something to eat.
Is that true?
It can be, but those are the kinds of thoughts and fears that we test in therapy to say, okay, how true is this and what's the worst thing that would happen if you don't eat and how can we start to break this cycle? But for many of these folks, food is the best sleep aid they have ever found, and often sleep aids make this problem worse.
So to a certain extent, it does work.
Yes. Yes, it becomes very reinforcing. It's comforting.
Yeah.
Nothing acts like food as well as food does to kind of soothe people very quickly. It's immediately reinforcing, and it really does seem to work for these folks to help them get back to sleep.
Hmm. So I wonder, is this now about an eating disorder or a sleep disorder?
It's a very good question, and we have sleep disorder folks that we collaborate with to really try to tease this out. There's something called sleep-related eating disorder where people are sleepwalking and eating, and that is definitely more of a parasomnia, and that's where it's listed in the classification system. The folks I see are generally aware of what they're doing, and interestingly, they have a very similar sleep period as people who don't have night eating. So they're not generally staying up all night to eat. They're going to bed, and they seem to be waking up at least about an hour to 90 minutes into the sleep cycle, which is unusual for sleep disorders. Usually insomnia happens in the middle of the sleep cycle or in the early morning time. So the pattern seems to be a little bit different from what we see in most sleep disorders, and people describe that drive to eat as the thing that's perpetuating the disorder.
I wonder about, now I'm going to turn back to you, Lucy. You know, we're talking about obesity in your case, and Kelly, in your case, we're talking about a syndrome here. But, I've become aware in my own life over the last week or so, I've been under great stress, nothing catastrophic, just more work and more commitments than I should have scheduled for myself. So that kind of stress that we all have. And I've also been aware that I have been more hungry. I usually don't have a big appetite, and I have been more hungry. So, you know, is that always work like that, Lucy?
Not always, but a lot of the time. So when you're stressed, what we know happens is that there are disruptions to what we call the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary axis, which controls stress hormones. And there can be many effects on your eating from these high levels of stress hormones, things like disruptions in your sleep and high levels of cortisol, which can actually lead to you having increased fat deposition, especially around your middle, your waist. And, of course, some people deal with stress by not eating, by eating less. They lose their appetite. But a great number of people have the opposite response, where they actually eat for comfort. And somehow that seems to make them feel better. And it's a very common coping mechanism for stress.
In my never-ending effort to make myself feel like I'm a normal person, I wonder if there's some evolutionary function to eating when we are under stress. I might need more energy, more protein in order to deal with what's in front of me.
Absolutely. You know, if you were being chased by a predator, that's probably one of the most stressful events that we could be under. One of the best things that you could do is make sure that you had enough food, enough fat deposits to last. If you were sort of confined to a cave, perhaps. So absolutely, I think that we've evolved to make sure that we have long-term fat deposits in case of emergency.
Kelly, I want to turn back to you. The work you're doing or beginning to do, I guess both of you, involve CBT,
yes.
Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Now, you don't have any controlled studies yet, or do you, showing outcome?
For night eating, no, we do not yet have any controlled trials. We've done a pilot study where we developed a cognitive behavioral therapy. We took pieces of what we know has worked for insomnia, for other eating disorders, and for weight control. And so we've had very promising results with that, but we have not been able to do a randomized trial, in part because, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, even though my colleague, Dr. Stunkert, first described night eating syndrome back in the 1950s, it's now just being recognized in what we call our psychiatric Bible, so to say, the DSM. And so we are hopeful that that will help us fund more studies so we can do something more rigorous.
You know, when I was preparing the show, I became aware that we have been throwing out this label, CBT, out more and more, and it's in the lay media more and more often. But nobody talks about what it really is. We've got on the phone someone who knows a bit about CBT. Her name is Judith Beck, and she's president of the Beck Institute for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. She's a clinical associate professor of psychology in the psychiatry department over at Penn, and she's internationally renowned in the field of CBT, and her name is similar to the guy who developed it, and that's Aaron Beck. That was her father. Judy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So listen, I know somebody that invented cognitive therapy even before your father, and that was my mother. My mother invented it before your dad, because when I would come home as a little kid and I would say, I'm upset because so-and-so-and-so did something to me, she'd say, well, don't think about that.
Yeah. So she already knew the connection between what you think and then how you feel and then maybe what you do behaviorally.
Yeah,
so she already knew that connection.
It didn't work.
Well, that's because trying to not think about something has been shown in the research maybe in the last 10 or 15 years to actually produce the opposite effect. When you try not to think about something, the thoughts seem to become more intense and more frequent. What we really try to do in cognitive behavior therapy is to help people identify the thoughts that they're having that are leading them to feel distressed or to behave in a way that's not toward their goals. And then we teach them how to evaluate their thinking, to look for the evidence that their thoughts are accurate or not accurate, and to change their thinking so that it's more realistic. When they do that, they feel better, and usually they can behave in a way that's more toward their goals. And this is completely applicable to weight loss and maintenance as well.
So let me, on behalf of many people out there who might be wondering, well, what about my emotions? I mean, I'm scared, or I'm depressed, or I'm obsessed. What about those? Are they going to go away? Aren't they what's driving my thoughts?
Well, there's a connection among all of these things, among the environmental situations or the internal environments, such as hunger, what you think, how you feel, and what you do. So what we find is that when people are able to talk back to their thoughts in a more effective way, then they feel better emotionally. I mean, that's the whole reason to even address your thoughts.
Literally,
is to feel better.
Are we literally talking back to our thoughts.
Well, I think that's what all of us do to a certain degree when we don't have a clinical depression. I think from time to time we all have thoughts such as, oh my goodness, I have so much work to do, I'll never get it done. And then sometimes we automatically will say to ourselves, well, that's not really true. I know it's going to be really pressured for the next couple of weeks, but, you know, I've always gotten it done in the past. I probably will this time, too. So that's what most of us kind of automatically do with many of our thoughts that are causing us stress. And what we're doing in CBT is really teaching people a structure for being able to recognize and respond in that way.
I think, you know, what this sounds like, and I know CBT is incorporating kind of formal mindfulness in this, but the whole issue of examining your thoughts is what we call metacognition. It's like taking a step back and looking at your thoughts, even looking at the nature of your mind, and that really does kind of take the pressure off of everything.
That's right. One of the things we try to teach people is just because I think something doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. It might be 100% true, in which case we probably have to do some problem solving and some acceptance. It might be somewhat true or it might not be true at all. But our emotions react to our thoughts as if the thoughts are completely true. That's right. Why we do need to take a step back.
Yeah, and especially with that critical judge, we react to that critical judge as though he or she is holds all the truth in the world. You know, when I was writing for the Inquirer years ago, I wrote a column comparing the mind to a poorly functioning kidney. You know, the kidney really filters out what's valuable and what is, well, waste. You know, but the mind doesn't do that. I mean, we just take what goes through the mind and say, oh, there's a thought, so that's real and valuable.
Especially when we're under stress. And the way that this bears on the topic for today is, especially with emotional eating, people frequently have two kinds of unhelpful thinking. One is, if I'm under stress, if I'm upset, tired, whatever it is, I deserve to eat. And the other one is, if I'm upset, the only way I can calm down is through eating. And both of these ideas really lead people who otherwise may have been, you know, fairly normal eaters to eat in a way
yeah.
that's not helpful.
And what we know is there's lots of ways we can calm ourselves down. We can, we know there's an awful lot of research about self-compassion out there and simple acts of kindness towards ourselves. Judy, I know you have to go. I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's been nice chatting with you. We wish you the best. We're going to have to take a short break right now. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Kelly Allison and Lucy Falconbridge. They're come to us from the Penn Center for Eating Disorders. Coming up, we're also going to hear from biomedical engineer Amit Geffen at Tel Aviv University. And of course, we would love to hear from you. Perchance, do you eat when you feel stressed? Do you feel guilty when you eat when you feel stressed or ashamed? And does that perpetuate the stress? Give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. or online at iamconcerned.org.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking with Drs. Kelly Ellison and Lucy Falconbridge from the Penn Center for Eating Disorders, and we're talking about the relationship between mood and eating. I have a feeling there might be a couple of you out there who might know something about that or have experience with that. Give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. Lucy, you've talked about a population of women who feel hungry all of the time and never satisfied. Now, there's, of course, a great deal of shame that goes with this, I imagine. I wonder if it involves some brain mechanisms that trigger satiation. You know, when we're sated, you know, something happens in the brain.
This is a really hot topic right now in research. One of the things we're trying to do is look at brain areas in humans and ask, are there differences in the brain between individuals who are overweight or obese and individuals who are lean? And what we're finding in these initial studies is that there are differences in the brain, such that when you give obese individuals pictures of high-calorie foods, things like a cupcake or a hamburger, their brain responds differently to when you show those same pictures to a lean person.
How so?
Well, the activity that we see is in an area of the brain called the mesolimbic dopamine system. Actually, several brain areas are activated, but this one is particularly interesting, this area, because it's the area of the brain that is also involved in drug abuse. So this is the area that gets activated if someone is a smoker or a cocaine addict. And so it's very interesting to researchers that this particular area shows a differential response between lean and obese individuals.
I know some of that research is being done in addition to you here at Drexel by Professor Michael Lowe. He's using EEGs to understand the brain's responses to food. I want to go to the phones. I wanted a follow-up question, but let's go to the phones first. We got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Linda? Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. What can we do for you?
Well, I think this is a very interesting topic, and I called to comment that I had been struggling with obesity most of my life and had very poorly managed depression. I didn't really respond to medications throughout the years, and it was a very chicken and egg thing for me. I was depressed because I was fat, I was fat because I was depressed, and it didn't ever seem to get any better until 6 years ago I had weight loss surgery. And I lost 140 pounds, and I have a whole new mood, emotion, brain system. I now see that sometimes there are bad days in a good life, as opposed to just being depressed all the time and seeing the negative. And I think it would actually be interesting to conduct an experiment like your guest was just discussing about the brain response to high-calorie foods and whether or not I would have the same reaction now that I did then, because I'm no longer obese. And my diet and my mind and my mood are completely changed. It was like a reset button for me.
I've got a question. Did you have counseling before and after, and was your family involved in that counseling?
I was in therapy pretty much all of my life, but definitely for the 10 years or so leading up to the surgery and since, with the same therapist. My family's been very, very supportive, and It was just a life changer for me. It was a game changer for me.
Yeah, I was
100%.
I was reading some preliminary studies about people who have weight loss surgery and don't have counseling, and it doesn't always go very well. I'll tell you in a minute about a patient of mine that had that exact, a very different experience from you, Linda. Lucy?
Well, first of all, Linda, congratulations for, first of all, being brave enough to sort of face some of the struggles and then to be so successful with losing 140 pounds with weight loss surgery. That's truly extraordinary. So I'm really happy for you. The study that you've talked about, it's such a good idea, and we're doing it actually right now at Penn. We are taking individuals who are going through bariatric surgery. We are placing them in an MRI scanner. That's a machine that looks at the brain, and then scanning them again 6 months and 18 months after they've had the weight loss surgery to look at exactly what changes are going on in the brain, precisely so that we can begin to understand some of the mechanisms that you've experienced personally.
And I echo that. I think it's thrilling that you lost this much weight and that you're feeling good about yourself and your life. You know, Lucy, I said I wanted to follow that up. I had a patient years ago who didn't have any counseling. She had weight loss surgery, and she was a young, attractive woman who went from obese to having a nice, attractive body, and she couldn't handle everything that was going on with, you know, people flirting with her, and she still saw herself as an obese person, not just thought of herself, probably experienced her body as she would an obese person. And I watched her put all that weight back on. So counseling is critical for any of this. Kelly?
We actually think that there aren't so many predictors for who will regain weight after surgery. So if you take a look at depression, and anxiety, at even eating disorders such as binge eating disorder, those are not really great predictors of who will regain weight. So we're not sure that counseling before surgery actually will get the bang for the buck after surgery. I think if somebody has severe symptoms, we absolutely always do recommend that they have therapy, and that's something that we do at Penn in our bariatric surgery program. But what we see is that sometimes when people are depressed, just as Linda on the phone had said, it is very weight related, and those folks tend to do quite well with surgery. But if they have depressive symptoms or other issues, and even maybe post-traumatic stress to do with child abuse, things like that, that they likely will have a rougher time after surgery. And so they need to be prepared that that might be an issue, and that they should seek therapy if for any reason they feel overly anxious with people commenting on their success, or that their mood gets more depressed after surgery.
Lucy?
Yeah, I completely agree with Kelly. And one of the interesting observations that has been found is that there is actually increased risk of suicide after bariatric surgery, and we're not sure why. So I echo your concern about your patient completely, in that if someone is experiencing difficulties coming to terms with the many changes that come with weight loss surgery, weight loss is one of the changes, but there are many other changes like body image and having people become attracted to you and interested in you romantically, and differences in the family dynamic, all of those things. I encourage people very strongly to go and seek help, because there are some instances of worsening mood after surgery and increased rates of suicide.
Yeah, you know, I think of this. My wife, many, many years ago, my late wife had cancer surgery on her leg. She was a young woman, and it was a malignant melanoma. They got it all out, but her leg was, you know, scarred terribly. And I was thrilled that the cancer was gone. I didn't care about the scarring, but you know, she lost a chunk of her leg. It's like a woman who loses a breast. I mean, it's you can't be thrilled. It's not just removing cancer. You know, it's removing, you know, a part of your identity, your self-image. You know, it's a tremendous loss, not just of weight. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Joan on the line. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Dan. How you doing?
Good. What can
Good.
We do for you?
Well, it's really nothing that you guys can do for me. I was listening to Channel 12 one time, and to put the cart before the horse, I started just eating really good food, nothing but fresh vegetables, fresh everything, and then reintroducing things very slowly. And I was lucky enough to find out what I'm allergic to. So I got rid of it, and I've suffered from depression for 55 years. It's pretty much gone. I'm getting off my meds slowly. And I said to my doctor, if you want to really be a hero to your patients, send your patient first to a nutritionist and then to a psychiatrist. Because I think, like you were saying, I think obesity is 15 pounds overweight. Is that what it is?
It depends on your height. But a body mass index of 30 or above would indicate obesity, and that's your height in your weight in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. So it varies a little, but
Joan, I think you're bringing up an important point, and that's really the complexity here. I mean, Joan's, and thanks for your call, by the way. Joan's bringing up the issue of food allergies, and that's got to be looked at. But there also seems to be a disconnect here between the nutritional push, the exercise push, and what you guys are doing, the psychology. I mean, you know, if you're depressed or you're living in a stressful environment or a deprived environment, and somebody offers you a carrot and somebody offers you a cupcake, come on. You know, a commercial's not going to drive you to the carrot. You know, so what about the disconnect? Kelly, do you have any insight?
Well, certainly in a lot of our folks, we do work on this emotional eating issue, and we do find that people tend to go for the highly palatable, more processed foods. And so part of it would be to change what they're eating and how, yes, then what else can they do to get pleasure instead of dwelling on, okay, I need to go into the drugstore and get my packet of chocolate and that's what I'm going to do tonight. It's like, no, let's change that. What else can you do tonight? And just as you would for some with plain depression and not the binge eating or night eating or overweight issues, you would want to do some kind of behavioral activation and basically say, if you continue to have this pattern and just sit at home with nothing to do, you're going to do the same thing over and over, and you're going to find that highly palatable foods do taste good and make you feel better. So we need to find other things for you to do and change your pattern of behavior at those risky times, whatever that time might be for a given person.
That's for an individual, and we've got to take a break when we come back. I mean, this obviously is a cultural issue. We can't separate the brain from the psyche to the larger culture. I mean, we've got to address all of them if we're going to have an impact. We're talking about the relationship between mood, stress, depression, and eating disorders, obesity, night eating syndrome, and the other eating disorders. My guests are Kelly Allison and Lucy Falconbridge, both psychologists who come to us from the Penn Center for Eating Disorders. Dr. Allison's the author of, Overcoming Night Eating Syndrome. And we'll have much more about their work. They're recruiting for volunteers. You'll get that on our webpage. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're taking calls right now on your relationship between your mood and eating, whatever experience you may or may not have had with that. Give us a call. Or in your family, did your parents eat when they were stressed or depressed? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. We'll be back right after this break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY-FM.
Support for WHYY comes from Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcoming clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bella Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and relationship problems. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the relationship between eating and mood with Drs. Kelly Allison and Lucy Falkenbridge. You know, we've been talking a lot about biology here, and in that context, I earlier spoke with Dr. Amit Geffen. He's at Tel Aviv University in Israel. Interestingly enough, he's a biochemical engineer who studies fat cells, specifically what happens to fat cells when people sit on them for extended periods of time. Let's listen to what he said.
What we have seen is that when you expose fat cells, which we call adipocytes, to these sustained loading conditions, basically to chronic static pressures or deformations, you accelerate the way by which these cells accumulate fat. So it's a rather different approach, not looking at nutritional aspects, but rather looking at how mechanics, solely mechanics, affects the cells.
So your research showed that these fat cells, when they're exposed to continuous pressure, like the one you describe, can expand as much as 50% of their normal size. This is true regardless of how many calories we're putting in our body?
Yes. We have exposed cells in a culture dish to the same nutritional conditions, but to different mechanical loading conditions. So all our cell cultures had the same supply of glucose, you know, sugars, all had the same supplies of other metabolites, all had oxygen supply, so nutritional conditions were the same. What we have changed in these cultures is the extent of deformations that the cells were experiencing. And this was the only factor that was different, and the cells responded to that. And the expansion in cell size that you have mentioned, that was the result of the static chronic deformations that physiologically you would experience again as if you were sitting in a chair.
The British medical journal Lancet published a series of studies on the health consequences of inactivities. I believe it was last year. But they found that a 15 to 30 minute daily walk is of little benefit if we sit 6 to 8 hours a day. Boy, that's really troubling.
It is. Probably the practical conclusion from the studies that we are doing and that others have published would be that you need this intermittent periods of cyclic loading to have the cells inhibit this adipogenic response. Because we know, for example, that bone and muscle tissues are being deteriorated when you sit in a chair or when you lie in bed, so there's no motion, whereas dynamically it would be like you would go for a walk or go to the gym or go for a run, and then the cells would be stretching and relaxing, deforming and relaxing.
I'll tell you, I mean, these cells sound like little children. If you don't give them something to do, bad things are going to happen here.
Exactly.
I'll tell you, I had to crack a joke at the end of that interview. I was so depressed about what he was saying. That was Dr. Amit Geffen, who's at Tel Aviv University in Israel. So, you know, we're listening to this Dr. Geffen talk about this, and I noticed in the other room the engineer over there, and both of my producers are all standing up watching. So sit down, everybody. It's okay. You can sit for a few minutes. But I was a little nervous. My guests here, Kelly and Lucy, were going to stand up. So that was really troubling, wasn't it, Kelly?
Well, I think there are just so many factors that play into what our shape and size is, where our fat deposits go. Everybody genetically is engineered a bit differently, their shape and size, and how their food processes different nutrients and macronutrients. And I think this is just one more example of things that maybe should help motivate us to get up and move around a little bit more, which could be helpful with our mood, with our stress levels, with our weight, all of those things together. So I think it's just another fascinating example of where our science is taking us.
I have to tell you, though, I have a dilemma when I'm treating my depressed patients, and I'll turn to you, Lucy. You know, I know lots of things they could do. You know, they could do yoga, and that would be helpful. Or, you know, aerobic exercise 4 or 5 times a week for 20 minutes, or change their eating. But they're depressed, and I don't want to load too much on them, if anything, really.
Absolutely. That's one of the hard things, because depression is characterized by several symptoms, but one of them is anhedonia, a loss of interest or pleasure in things that you used to enjoy. Depressed people often experience lack of motivation, they're tired all the time, they can't concentrate. And so one of the things that we worried about was, are we putting too much on depressed individuals, asking them to adhere to a diet, asking them to fill out food diaries, asking them to adhere to a rigorous exercise program? And one of the things that we urge individuals to do in our treatments is exactly what Judy Beck said, is to question their own thinking. Often a depressed person might think, oh, there's no point me even trying, I won't be able to do this, when in fact they find that if they just do it for 5 minutes, it's not that bad, and hey, look at me, I actually am doing this walk. And so one of the things that we're doing is trying to have people test their assumptions about what they can and can't do. And maybe they won't have been able to do it in the past, but that doesn't mean they won't be able to do it in the future. If you look at anyone undertaking any kind of behavioral change, whether it's giving up smoking or losing weight, the people who are successful probably didn't do it the first time they tried. So most ex-smokers will tell you, oh yeah, I tried to give up, 10 times before I was actually successful. And the same is true of people who are successful at maintaining a weight loss. They tried multiple times, and in the end, something stuck. It's no different for individuals with depression. So I think that we have to, as clinicians, even question our own assumptions about what our patients can and can't do. Some patients may feel the burden of weight loss. Other people can actually do more than we think they can.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Peter on the line. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Hi. What can we do for you?
I'm 58 years old. I deal with this myself. I eat at night. I like eating at night. I understand some of the stress part. The stress is, it's a relief to just sit there with nobody bothering you. I got a young kid. I got 2 older kids. I'm married a second time. I can be called into work at any time. Things like that that ride on my mind, why am I doing this? Because I know I'm overweight. I don't consider myself a beast, but I'm definitely overweight. And then you enter into this thing called depression. Well, I really don't, I don't think I'm depressed. I mean, I'm tired. Where's the line between tired? So I guess I got a 3-part question. Where's the line between tired and depressed? Is this a normal thing for a 58-year-old male in the United States, Northeast, to, worry about job, future, retirement, especially retirement, and be bothered with all these things, and have a little food at night, to make himself happy? You're talking like it's a, I know it can lead to other things, and we care about health care, but you're talking like it's a major concern. My wife seems to think it's a major concern. For some reason, she wants me around longer. But
wait a minute. Was that a joke, that last statement, or was it a half a joke? For some reason, she wants you...
Sir, don't get me wrong. It's a half joke.
Okay. All right. So I wonder, what is your mood in general? Let's see if you can answer some of these questions. So what is your mood? And forget labels like depression and so on and so forth.
My coping mechanism for years has been, you know what? I'm going to do the best I can with what I got every day, get up, face, try to be pleasant to people. And that's all I can do. I mean, that's all the tools I ever got. I didn't know I was sick. I didn't know I was depressed. I didn't know I'm trying to do the best I can with what I have. And some days I falter. And I don't eat every night overnight. Lately it's been getting a little more. I got a little bit more concerned. I'm doing Cub Scouts. I'm doing all kinds of things. But I know I want to lose weight, and I don't know how to deal with it. And if it's a mental aspect, I'd love to know how to deal with the mental aspect of it.
Okay. Well, what we're learning on the show is it's not 100% mental, but you can use your mental facilities to sure help here. Kelly, why don't you comment?
Sure.
For Peter?
So I hear your concern about trying to over-pathologize what you're doing, like make it a disorder. And certainly lots of people eat at night, and they're not at all distressed about it. And if you can, if that's your lifestyle, and if it doesn't bother you, it doesn't concern others, and it's not impacting, then we don't want to over-pathologize it. But it does sound like, you are concerned on some levels. And a lot of people who eat with this pattern do find that they gain weight and then they have trouble losing it. And, there is a biological concern. We don't have a lot of great human data, but animal models have really shown us that eating at night actually, well, for them during the day, because they're nocturnal, they actually store the energy differently, and it does store as fat more readily than animals who eat during the time they're supposed to be eating. And we think maybe this is happening in humans, which is why it may be that eating at night actually causes waking, but we're still testing that. So that could be part of the concern, is that, also if you're eating at night and you're tired, as you're saying, you're probably choosing foods that you might be a little bit more hesitant to eat during the day because you are tired and you don't want to argue with yourself about, is this good for me or is it not? And so those factors are what come into play. And so having a plan as you start your day, going into the evening to say, okay, I am going to have a snack at night, but let me really consider what my choices are and what makes the most sense given what my goals are. And if your goals are to feel better and to lose some weight, having that structure actually could be really helpful so that you have a portion-controlled snack. And it could be something you still really like and still get enjoyment out of, but you don't sit there with, end up eating way more than you had planned. And that's what tends to get us into trouble.
And let me comment on the other dimensions of your question. Depression aside, you talked about all the stressors in your life, and this is a stress issue. Is it normal to have stress? Well, I don't know how you define stress. It's certainly not unusual to have the issues you would have as a 58-year-old man. Many are worried about their job. Many are worried about retirement. Sure. If your stress that you're experiencing is causing you harm, then it needs to be looked at. Then perhaps we can take a look at the stress and do something to help you manage your stress. If it's an issue between, you and your wife, if you don't see it as a problem and she does, and it's leading to marital discord, well, then maybe it's a marital issue. So let's not just focus narrowly. Let's look at Peter and his life and his family life and see what can be done to diminish the suffering. I mean, that's the question any good clinician is going to ask. Peter, we don't have time to develop this any further. I sure hope this was helpful for you, and I do wish you the best. By the way, there's a lot of programs around to help deal with stress management. I know University of Pennsylvania has one. Jefferson has one with their Department of Integrative Medicine. And University of Pennsylvania has one. And we will put a link to their website on our web page. I've got a question, and I guess this is for you, Lucy. The treatment of choice for depression is medication. And, did I get a funny look from her, is medication and psychotherapy, the medications we put people on tend to add weight to their bodies. So what are you going to do to fix that, doctor?
Absolutely. That's a really important thing for depressed individuals to think about if they're concerned about their weight. So yes, I often see in my office individuals who are struggling with weight, they're suffering from depression, and they're on and some kind of either antidepressant or antipsychotic medication that we know is weight gaining. And so often psychiatrists who are prescribing these medications or even primary care physicians, they're trying to help the depression. And so they're appropriately prescribing medication, but they're not thinking about some of the weight gaining effects of those medications.
Big picture, right.
And so what I would urge practitioners as well as patients to do is to ask questions about, hey, is this medication likely to affect my weight? Is it going to make me more hungry? Is it going to make me tired so that I can't go out and exercise?
And is it going to make me feel more depressed about being overweight? So I guess the rule of thumb is for physicians is for what we all did mm-hmm. with our caller, Peter. You know, you've got to treat a patient and mm-hmm. not symptoms.
That's right.
And,
that's right.
You know, that's what any good doctor is going to do. Well, we've been talking about night eating syndrome, obesity, and depression. Kelly Allison, thanks so much for joining us. Lucy Falkenbridge, thank you. We also heard earlier from Amit Geffen, and we also heard from Judith Beck. Should say that there's a fundraiser coincidence. The Beck Institute is one of our underwriters here at WHYY. By the way, I've got a new book out, The Wisdom We're Born With. I'll be speaking about it tonight at 6:30 at the Barnes & Noble at Rittenhouse Square. Do me a favor. Do all of us a favor. Come on down there and hang out with me. I'd love to see you face to face. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about contagious stress. And some of us may know something about that. You're with somebody who is always seemed to be stressed out. And you know what happens to your body. You know, you wind up with a tight chest. So we're going to be talking about contagious stress and what we can do about it. Well, to download our podcast, we're at whyy.org/voices. At Twitter, we're at Voices in the Fam, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show's been a stand-up guy, Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luner's executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends. Thank you.